A remote fantastical kingdom far from Europe's chancelleries of power. An ancient castle where secrets are walled up. An unpopular monarch on the eve of his coronation. A ruling class of plotters and would-be usurpers. And a gentleman adventurer on holiday. No, not Ruritania in the 19th century, but the United Kingdom in the 21st. Stein's new book, The Prisoner of Windsor, is a contemporary inversion of Anthony Hope's classic, The Prisoner of Zenda. In the original, an English gentleman on vacation is called upon to stand in for his lookalike, the King of Ruritania, at his coronation. Over a century later, a Ruritanian on vacation in London is called upon to return the favour and stand in for an Englishman in an absurd fantastical kingdom where Brexit never quite happened. Plots are afoot. The Prisoner of Windsor by Mark Stein. Available in hardback and digital editions, or for a personally autographed copy, go to steinonline.com.
The Stein Online Clubland Q&A begins right now. 'Cause you've been found and convicted of a serious crime.
It's the guilty party right here, as determined by a jury of my peers. April 10th, 2024. 2 days after what the US media are calling the Great American Eclipse, even though my kids report that it looked fantastic from both the top of the mountain in Montreal and even from Hamilton, Ontario, the two municipalities where they happen to be this week. Hamilton, of course, famed as the hometown of our late friend Kathy Schadl, whom we miss so much. In North America and Europe, our time zones have realigned, but in the Southern Hemisphere, they have fallen back to winter. So it is 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 4 p.m. in the beautiful Canadian Maritimes, 4:30 p.m. in fabulous Newfoundland, and beyond the Americas, 8 p.m. British summertime, 9 p.m. in Paris, 10 p.m. in Jerusalem, half past 10 in Tehran for all you Newfoundlanders who moved to Iran for the half-hour time zone, midnight 45 in Kathmandu for all you Iranians who moved to Nepal to check out the quarter-hour time zone, 3 a.m. in Singapore and Honkers, awfully sorry about that, 5 a.m. in Sydney and Melbourne, still very sorry about that too. 7 a.m. in Auckland, yeah, maybe I'm sorry about that as well. But a rather more convivial hour for the Kippers and Kedgeri in His Majesty's dominions further east across the Pacific. Not much of a voice today and a bit over-medicated, but I'm going to do my best to stagger through to the end of the hour. Man vs. Stein is now cruising into its 13th year, just before I came on air. 3 minutes before I came on air, some new motion was filed in the District of Columbia Superior Court, where justice goes to die. Meanwhile, we're just 2 months from my other court date in the King's Bench Division in London against the UK media censor Ofcom. That's June 11th. I thank all of you who, in order to show support for one or other of both of these free speech cases, have bought a Chum, a Stein Online gift certificate or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. The King's Bench Division is one thing, because these cases, I think this case was filed late summer last year, and we had a court date in February, and then Ofcom said, no, we're washing our hair in February, so it got postponed to June. But that's, you know, that's basically... That was basically, as the court saw it, 6 months soup to nuts, not 13 years and counting, as in the evil District of Columbia court system. These are bad times for free speech in Scotland, in Ireland, in Canada, but most of all in America. If you haven't, I mentioned this yesterday, but if you haven't read it, I urge you to do so, because as awful as my experiences have been in American courts, what is happening to VDare.com, that's Peter Brimelow's anti-immigration website, he thinks quite reasonably that the Ted Kennedy's 1965 Immigration Act was a disaster for America. And whether you agree or not with that, it's certainly not something that should be you should be destroyed if you advance that position. Yet that is what the evil state of New York, and actually that should be destroyed. Sorry, start spreading the news. Let's destroy it today. But that particular state, the Attorney General, Letitia James, the same one who's gone after Trump for a victimless crime, where she basically found a corrupt judge willing to confiscate $500 million from him for a victimless crime. She's even worse with VDare. VDare haven't been convicted of a crime. They haven't, in fact, been charged with a crime. But another corrupt judge has basically agreed to let Letitia James go on a fishing expedition that is absolutely ruinous for VDare.com. They have to, cough up whatever it is, 20 years worth of emails, and reveal the names of anyone who's had any truck with them, which is disgusting, because the idea, obviously, is so that those people can be targeted and destroyed. And this is the difference. As I said, I think it was a couple of days after the verdict came through in my own case. The difference between, you know, litigation in America and everywhere else is that it's ruinous here. It just is. Whatever you've saved. I always point out the example of Peter Navarro asking me just before he came on air if I could plug his book, because he was hoping to use his book royalties to fund his legal defense. Well, he's in jail right now. That didn't work out great for him, did it? And as I said to him, unless you're J.K. Rowling, nobody's book royalties are enough to be able to afford to be in American litigation. My old GB News comrade Lawrence Fox was found guilty of defaming somebody in the High Court in London, and not sure whether he's had the fine for that yet, but it'd be like a couple of £1,000. So you take your lumps and you move on. Here it destroys you. And they're using it to destroy VDare without, as I said, even a conviction or even the charge of a crime. And I'm tired of the Nancy Boy right. Or you know the guys, all the guys with the Butch bumper music and the easy listening opinions, they've got nothing to say about this case. It moves all this. The reason I talk about first principles all the time is because the assumption is always that is this a soccer expression? Playing the man, not the ball. People never look at it. They think, oh, VDare, their opinions were a bit strong meat. When I got into trouble in Canada, the other case going through the Human Rights Commission at that time was a guy called Mark Lemire, who had some sort of neo-Nazi. I mean, not really neo-Nazis, but he's, you know, he had a sort of skinhead effect and whatever. He was the totally unsympathetic character. And so everyone's saying, well, so you come up. So I then get instead and I start going, well, these Canadian Human Rights Commissions, there's no due process. There's truth is not a defense. And everyone goes, oh, so you're defending that Nazi, Mark Lemire. And I go, yes, because in a land of laws, if you run a stoplight and kill a little old lady, it doesn't make any difference if you run down the little old lady, whether you're Hitler or Nelson Mandela, not in a land of law. And so everyone said, oh, so I wound up, and in fact, Mark Lemire, once I'd actually pointed that out to a large number of Canadians, they say, oh, yeah, maybe he's got a point on that. You're right. It shouldn't make any difference if you run a stoplight and kill a little old lady, whether you're Hitler or Nelson Mandela. And in fact, we panicked the judge. He suddenly decided that the law on which Mark Lemire was being dragged in before the Human Rights Tribunal was unconstitutional and announced he wasn't going to hear any more cases under it. But yet, Conservative Inc. Oh no, they talk a bit. They're a bit strong meat about mass immigration, so they're not saying anything. You think the argument? Letitia James actually said this in public to other businesses, rattled by what she'd done to Trump. Said, "Oh, don't worry. Once we've destroyed Trump, that's it. That's going to be an end of it." Okay, now she's destroying VDare. You think she's not going to come after your little pansy, squish, rhino, pseudo-conservative operation? No, they want a world in which there is not just no effective dissent, no red meat dissent, but they want a world where there is no kind of dissent. Sorry about that. It wasn't even a question about that, but I want to get that out there because I think it's important. On this day, 80 years ago, April 10th, 1944, two Jews escaped from Auschwitz, which was the Third Reich's big concentration camp in Poland. You have to explain that today because I get the feeling hardly anybody's heard of it now. A fortnight later, so that's getting on toward the end of April 1944, Rudolf Wirba and Alfred Wetzler had made it to Žilina in Slovakia, where they provided a detailed, relentless, unflinching eyewitness account of the industrial-scale extermination of people in Auschwitz. And it prompted Hungary's regent, Admiral Horthy, to halt the deportations of Jews from Budapest, and thus is estimated to have saved roughly a quarter of a million lives. As the great historian Sir Martin Gilbert observed, quote, "No other single act in the Second World War saved so many Jews from the fate that Hitler had determined for them." The so-called Wirba-Wetzler report was eventually translated into English by America's War Refugee Board, and upon publication was called by the New York Herald Tribune the most shocking document ever issued by a United States government agency. Mr. Wetzler died in Bratislava in 1988, Mr. Wirba in Vancouver in 2006, a long way from Auschwitz, whence they escaped 8 decades ago today. Speaking of getting out in time, headline of the day from CNBC. The rich, that would be the American rich, the rich are getting second passports citing risk of instability. That would be risk of American instability. The rich are getting second passports citing risk of instability. When the powder keg goes up, they'll be a long way away. Let us get to your questions. George Pereira writes, Mark, what are kippers and kedgeree? If 7 a.m. in Auckland is a more convivial hour for them, what is a less convivial hour? Well, kippers are, I always say kippers and kedgeree in the recitation of the time zones for our friends listening over breakfast in the Pacific. Kippers is a type of smoked herring. Kedgeree is also smoked fish, but in this case, haddock. I know some people do it with salmon and whatnot. I don't really go for it when they if it's not haddock. Smoked haddock, flake sort of haddock flakes with rice, parsley, eggs, and curry powder. I'm trying to think if there's anything else that's used in them. It's a dish that was brought back to Britain from India, although I noticed that the Scots claim it as one of their own. I don't believe that for a moment. It's from India, certainly not from Scotland, although you can run that by Humza Yousaf. He might be able to give you chapter and verse on that. And the reason I put them together is that kippers are regarded as a bit day class A. There's a shorthand for what they regard as lower middle class pretensions in England. Oh, she's a bit kippers and curtains. You know, they've got fancy curtains in the window, but they're eating kippers behind the curtains. And Kedgeree is, of course, you know, upscale thing for when you come down for breakfast at Downton Abbey or whatever. The only time I ever have kippers, not really a big, I love Kedgeree, which I've never found in America. There's a few places in Montreal that do Kedgeree. One that does a sort of Quebecois version of Kedgeree. Whereas kippers, I only have if I'm staying at my club in London, where the lady there makes absolutely fantastic kippers. Okay, that's out of the way. On to the important stuff. Chris Hall says, "Hi, Mark. Have you heard about the group of roughly 2,000 elderly Swiss ladies winning a case in the European Court of Human Rights where they claim that the Swiss government had not done enough to prevent heat waves? Now, normally, one doesn't associate with Switzerland with heat waves, but are the Swiss now pining for the days when their glaciers were much longer and covered their now verdant valleys?" In case you haven't seen this European Court decision, there were 17 judges. All 16 signed off on this cockamamie judgment. And the 17th, he's also hot for all the global warming. The only difference is that he rightly recognises that his 16 colleagues on that bench, his 16 fellow jurists, are just pulling this judgment out of their butts. Let's say that for the sake of argument, that climate change is global warming, whatever is happening. Why? It's called global warming because it's global. What is the Swiss government supposed to do about it? Switzerland is a small, landlocked country surrounded by far, you know, bigger economies such as the French. You know, the big thing, obviously, in Switzerland is Swiss bank accounts, which don't generate a lot of carbon dioxide, you know, CO2, not like what they're doing in with, say, German automobiles or whatever. So it's got Italy, France, Germany, all these countries around it. And its ability to have any impact on the world's climate is negligible. But nevertheless, these 16 jurists on the European Court of Human Rights now feel differently about it. And this is, again, this is exactly like the case I just talked about, Mark Lemire, the so-called neo-Nazi in Canada, who eventually, they were holding a secret trial of him, and my great KC, QC, as he was then, Queen's Counsel, Julian Porter. I said, this is ridiculous, secret trial. These guys, these idiots think they're like James Bond. Let's open it up and see it in public. And he wrote a two-page motion, and those bastards have never held a secret trial ever again. But that's why first principles are important. Otherwise, you get what you got in this case, which is where they decide the desired outcome. Oh, this would be Greta Thunberg was in the gallery for this decision. That's how important this is. This is a major international court now ruling that the right to have climate change ameliorated by your government is a human right. So again, it goes back to what I was saying about that Canadian case, where basically you decide the outcome you want. Oh, bad man, neo-Nazi man, sitting in his mum's basement writing stuff on the internet. That's a bad man. So we should have a sit. We need to construct a legal process that will stop the bad man. And that's not, and it's the same thing here. Oh, climate change is very serious. So climate change can't be seen to lose here. So we have to come up with a legal argument which will ensure that the cause of climate change triumphs. Disgusting. I'm up before the European Court of Human Rights if stuff goes badly for me in the High Court in London. So we'll see how that goes. Ben Poser writes, "Dear Mark, if your great hockey match with the son of man, M-A-N-N, is indeed not over, then I'm at a loss as to how to continue, as by far the closest to a climate scientist of the dueling two. Do you believe, even beyond the ICDC rink, ICDC rink? I thought it said ACDC rink, that the public can be informed of the fact that one of the most befuddling areas of Earth science has been transformed into the most settled and solid. Worse still is the assumption that touching a thermostat or winging one's way over to EU beaches crammed with nude syphilitic Nobel Prize winners can actually alter the Earth's atmosphere. The Greenland Vikings didn't need Herr Schwab to freeze themselves out of Hörjulsen in the 15th century. More to the point, any self-respecting leather book with gold Hebrew writing on it doesn't mention the human ability to cause drought. I hope skating from a wheelchair is more comfortable, sir, and may the 270-word blog post ramifications not manifest as the 270 years war." What I learned from that case was lost in jury selection, where every potential juror said that they believed in climate change. Now, some of them genuinely believed in climate change. Others just did so because it's in the air and they're in Washington, D.C., and several others, whatever their private skepticism, including at least one juror, thought it was, you know, whatever, but were cowed by all the people around them. That's what we're up against. And I think, just to put it in, you know, so we lost on jury selection because it's the new state religion. Religion is in decline among, you know, continental Europe is basically totally post-Christian. America is, you know, a generation behind that trend. But for white liberals, the void where their faith, however residual, you know, if they are Episcopalians or Congregationalists or whatever they were, that hole has now been filled with climate. To complete with the laying on the hands of Greta. And it's very hard. The lesson I learned is that that's simply, it's everywhere. You can take all the CO2 out of the atmosphere, and all that's going to be left in the atmosphere then is climate propaganda. Heiko Heino says, "Dear Mark, since you personally know Boris Johnson, do you think he feels responsible for subverting the Ukraine peace deal in April 2022. This caused the population of Ukraine to plummet from 35 million to 24 million today, since all these people have escaped Ukraine to Russia and the West. It also caused about 500,000 men to die in the war and another 1.5 million to become permanently disabled." I don't know about these figures, but just going on Ukraine's figures, they say that half a million Russians, 450-something thousand Russians, have died in the invasion of Ukraine. It seems reasonable to think that the same number of Ukrainians have died, but there's a far lower number of them. This is fascinating. Well, it's first war fought between two countries with deathbed demography. And when I say fascinating, it's not really fascinating. It's terrible because, as you know, they're running out of cannon fodder. They're running out of people to send into the field to get killed by the Russians. And so regardless of who wins this war, it is going to take a generation or two, if it's even possible, for Ukraine to recover economically, never mind demographically, because just economically, it doesn't. Your economy is stymied if you don't have enough young men around to sire children, even on the collapsed birth rates of Ukraine. Now, does Boris feel responsible for jetting in and subverting the Ukraine peace deal? No, I don't think he does at all. I think this whole racket, Boris needs to feel important. There was a really rather creepy piece about him and another old friend of mine from the Telegraph Spectator days, Charles Moore. They're playing tennis in Boris's garden in Oxfordshire. And Boris says after the tennis, tell you what, why don't we go to Ukraine? So they go off to Ukraine, and Boris is treated as a great hero there by official Ukraine in Kiev. I very much doubt he is. You know, this is as Blinken said with Cameron in Washington yesterday, I think it was, it's great for the US economy. The Ukrainian war, according to Antony Blinken, is great for the economy. The fact that it's not great for Ukraine's economy, it's not great for the Ukrainian people, whose population, as what did Heike say? He said 24 million. That's basically half of what it was 30 years ago when it became an independent nation. Again, these are terrible things. These are terrible things. Tony Allwright writes from Dublin and says, Ukraine's Ministry of Defence, oh, here we are, tweets jubilantly that Russia has lost 450,000 men, 14,000 armoured combat vehicles, and tens of thousands of other bits of military hardware. The sad truth is that Russia, with four times the population of Ukraine, six times the GDP, 10 times the landmass, and a total disregard for its own casualties, can sustain these losses. Ukraine cannot, especially with its rapidly depleting manpower. Hence, Ukraine's stark choice is to continue fighting and thereby lose all of Ukraine to Russia, or else to negotiate. I'd slightly disagree with that, Tony. Because I don't think Vladimir Putin wants to try holding all of Ukraine, by which I mean, you know, down to the Bukovina and west over to the Hungarian border. He knows that he would not be able to hold all that. An outline deal, but what's interesting is that whatever is left of Ukraine after it's enjoyed the benefit of the Joe Biden, Lindsey Graham war machine, Joe Biden, Lindsey Graham, Boris Johnson war machine for another couple of years, will be that what remains of Ukraine will not be either demographically or economically a viable state. But Tony continues, hence Ukraine's stark choice is to continue fighting and thereby lose all of Ukraine to Russia, or else to negotiate. An outline deal might be formal cession of the Crimea and Donbass to be endorsed by the international community, which would be a major win for Putin, in exchange for Russian retreat to the pre-invasion borders of 19th February 2020, which Putin might just about swallow for a quiet life. So my question is, do you think that this is a realistic outcome and that Ukraine will ignore it and fight until bitterly defeated? Well, that is actually the most obvious, you know, the most obvious settlement. And it might have gone better if you'd been on that plane with Boris Johnson over to Kiev. The fact of the matter is, you say, will Ukraine ignore it and fight until bitterly defeated? The Ukrainian population has been ground down and demoralized, but they're not calling the shots, as it were, as we've just been talking about. Washington is calling the shots, and Washington, for reasons of its own, wants to keep this war going in the same way that it liked keeping Afghanistan going. The difference then was that there was more controversy at home because there were actual Americans dying. Now it's just a bunch of no-name foreigners who are dying. And so the political calculation for those evil people in Washington is a lot easier. A lot easier to make. Here's the reality. Tony Allwright is writing from Dublin, so this won't be news to him. As long as this has gone on, I've always made the comparison that Ukraine to Russia is a bit like Ireland to England. That is to say, in Ireland, there are people who consider themselves both Irish and British, and there are people in Ireland who want to be just Irish. There's two kinds of people. One, Ireland. And so I know, you know, that when you go into a bar in Boston and some tedious Irish-American tosspot is bending your ear, think, oh, it's one island. It would make much more sense for it to be one country. Well, the country. Well, yeah, that's true. Why don't you tell that to the Dominican Republic, that it would make much more sense for them to be part of Haiti, or Papua New Guinea, it would make much more sense for them to be part of Indonesia. The fact is, There's people in Ireland who want to be just Irish, and there's people in Ireland who want to be both Irish and British. And if you don't accept that basic core, you can argue about the percentages and the percentages shift, but if you don't accept that basic characterization, you're not likely to make any useful contribution to the debate. Well, it's the same in Ukraine. It's the same in Ukraine. There are Ukrainians who want to be just Ukrainian, and there are Ukrainians who want to be both Ukrainian and Russian. And Putin knows which ones are where. And Nikki Haley and Lindsey Graham don't have a bloody clue about it. Okay, that's the way that's going. Let us pause a moment from the passing Charivari for a bit of unfinished business, really, I would say. On January the 16th this year, Laurie Johnson died at the grand old age of 96. But January the 16th happened to be the first day of my trial in the dank septic tank of the District of Columbia Superior Court. So I set Laurie's death to one side, intending to come back to it when events permitted. And instead, all kinds of other things intervened. It wasn't a good month for me. So I'd just like to play this piece of music for me. And if nobody else likes it, tough. It's just for me. Laurie Johnson was a fabulous composer and arranger in any number of fields. The last time I saw him was over lunch when he wanted to talk about a proposed revival of Lock Up Your Daughters. What a triggering title. You couldn't even have anything called Lock Up Your Daughters now. That was the musical he wrote with Lionel Bart, based on Henry Fielding's Rape Upon Rape. But he also wrote fabulous film scores. I'll name just one Laurie Johnson film, Dr. Strangelove. And he wrote magnificent television themes. This is one I adore. His theme for The Avengers. Not the stupid, bloated Marvel Comics franchise. I'm so bored with superheroes because a world of superheroes leads to a world without non-superheroes. And non-superheroes are what we could surely use right now. So not the superhero Avengers, but the super cool British telly series, The Avengers, with Patrick McNeice, John Steed, and Honor Blackman, Diana Rigg, and Linda Thorson. as his successive sidekicks. This is Laurie Johnson's fabulous theme tune. Laurie made a great record of it in 1965, but the series ran until the end of the decade, so I've edited in a few extra bits he put in later, such as the high trumpet in the first reprise of the main strain to introduce Tara King, played by my fellow Torontonian, the wonderful Linda Thorson. Linda's a good friend of our pianist, Jeff Eales, who you've seen on our Christmas shows and whatnot. So I stuck that in just for Jeff and Linda, and also the fabulous percussive intro as Patrick McNee strolls on with a bottle of champagne and, after loosening the wire, holds it out for Diana Rigg as Mrs. Peel to shoot the cork off it, after which he coolly pours two glasses of the fizz. Don't try that at home, boys and girls. Enjoy Laurie Johnson's great composition, The Avengers. Johnson and his orchestra with the theme to The Avengers. Laurie died on the first day of my trial in the District of Columbia. Cracking stuff. Mark Stein live around the planet. It is 23 to 4 North American Eastern Time. That is 23 before 9 British Summer Time. A little behind, a lot ahead, according to where you chance to be on this turbulent earth. Let us get back to your questions. Mark Shear says, the full eclipse passing through my town made me think of you and your occasional quote of Bogart. Humphrey Bogart, that would be. I'm concerned that nobody knows anything anymore, so you'll forgive me if I'm annotating. I'm getting a bit like the terrible
sub-editors I used to have when I wrote for the New York Times occasionally, it would just be putting speed bumps in your prose the whole time. So if you said, oh, the novel is rather Dickensian, they'd then have a subordinate clause explaining who Charles Dickens was. I'm getting a bit like that. Mark says, anyway, he's channeling Humphrey Bogart in Casablanca. The full eclipse passing through my town made me think of you and your occasional quote of Bogart. I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Does the vastness of the heavens perhaps bring you some comfort in these troubled times? Well, it ought to be humbling. It wasn't actually, and I know, you know, because of all the rubbish about it going through Rapture, Indiana, so that must be God's way of giving us a heads up for the rapture. And then the other people saying, oh, no, that's just a sign. It's an obvious deep state, false front operation. I know all that's rubbish, but it was actually humbling. That moment at whatever it was, 25 past three Eastern time, when the last bit of the sun went out and suddenly there's this crepuscular gloom. Someone took a rather good photograph of me in front of the crepuscular gloom that's up at Stein Online. It is humbling. But at the same point, I remember thinking at that moment when the sun had gone out, I was thinking, this is going to be what it's like all day, every day, if Bill Gates gets his way on shooting stuff into space to turn down the sun. Because Bill Gates, as you know, Bill Gates's plan is to save the planet from global warming by creating a huge operation that will act effectively as a dimmer switch on the sun. And I remember thinking, because you're right, it's a humbling thing. The heavens, the vastness of the heavens, as Mark says, is an awesome thing and ought to be a humbling thing. Yet at that very moment, all I thought of was what it was going to be like. This is what it'll be like if Bill Gates ever gets whoever's responsible, the UN or the World Health Organization or the European Court of Human Rights, to sign off on his plan to turn down the sun. Hart says, Mark, welcome back. Considering the continual degradation of the US, I was wondering as to when we can expect your next book titled Autopsy of America, likely the last photocopier in the Wood Samizdat version in Arabic. In anticipation of the coming collapse of the dollar and of our insidious debt-based economy, how practical will gold be in such a dystopian society? Many conservative pundits and websites are strongly and repeatedly promoting the purchase of gold, but I remain confused as to the practicality of gold's worth in such an economy, especially where inflation will continue to grow. Yes, I have an ounce of gold, but if at some point that ounce of gold will be required to buy a loaf of bread, how valuable will it be? It may remain valuable for some date in the future, but as a practical medium of exchange, I just don't see it. I'd greatly appreciate your thoughts. That's very true. And of course, it will become, you know, it will become illegal to trade in gold. Once the dollar collapses and... you know, why is it not going to collapse? I wrote my book after America, I think, when the debt was $10 trillion. Then it went up to $20 trillion. And $10 trillion was shocking because it's an amount of money that had, or an amount of debt, an IOU, the size of which the world had never seen. But then it went up to $20 trillion. And then when it went, then it's gone up over $30 trillion now. So the fact when it hits $40 trillion or $50 trillion, is anybody in Washington going to take it seriously? No. So collapse is becoming a, the collapse of the dollar is becoming a certainty now. The only question is when the Chinese, when they get together with the Russians and the Mullahs and whoever else, when they want to arrange it for. And at that point, you know, whatever it is, your $3 million 401k will suddenly be worth $1.37. And at that point, because it's about state control, you won't be able to trade gold. They'll forbid you trading gold. But the point about it, I slightly disagree, because gold is a thing and gold will have the value that it would have, that it will have. It has an inherent value. It's not like a fiat currency. It's not like a piece of paper saying I promise to pay the bearer on demand £10 or $10 or whatever. It has an inherent value, gold. Thing is, as you say, so it's not going to be able to buy you a loaf of but it won't be able to buy you a loaf of bread, because in that situation, it's more or less like Mark Twain's famous £1 million banknote, which we did as one of our tales for our time, where these guys give a penniless American a £1 million banknote, and he's in London, and he you can't get someone to give you change for £1 million banknote. So he goes to a restaurant. He says, "Oh, I've only got £1 million banknote on me." "Oh, never mind. You can get it for us next time." And similarly, he goes to a tailor in German Street, and he's fitted out with a new suit. And "Oh, no, I've only got this £1 million banknote." "Oh, well, never mind. So you can get it for..." So either that's, if you want your loaf of bread, you can show your gold, ounce of gold, or your brick of gold or whatever, but you're not... the guy isn't going to be able to give you change for that. But on the other hand, might be impressed enough by you to give you the loaf of bread. Or he might demand that you give him something of practical use to him now. So it'll be a barter society in which so you'll go to get a loaf of bread, and in return you'll give him a chicken or something. I doubt we'll even get to that, because I think it's going to be incredibly violent and convulsive. And you're going to it'll be more important to have ammunition than gold, because you're when the powder keg goes up, there are going to be all kinds of, wherever you are, there's going to be all kinds of crazies coming out from the depraved Democrat cities to get what you've got on your farm. It's not going to be pretty. Kelly Walter says, "Mark, continued prayers for your health and your ultimate victories in your court cases. I just renewed my club membership." Well, I thank you for that, Kelly. I am enormously grateful. Tell some friends about the club. We have fun in the club, I like to think. You often encourage us to take a stand for first principles. For those of us without the benefit of a serious education, could you identify these first principles for us? I would like to have a clear idea of what I am fighting for. Also, I trust that in the midst of your busy schedule, you are carving out time for a first-rate autobiography. The personal tidbits and encounters that you share from time to time are fascinating and would make a great read. What a treasure for your heirs and admirers. Well, you know, that's the other thing with these stupid lawsuits, is that I think from time to time of all the projects... all the time was just taken up by stupid lawsuits. As I said, in America, and this is why people should actually put in a word for VDARE, because you have no idea that what they're being... VDARE is basically Peter Brimelow and his missus. And so on the one side, you have the state of New York demanding everything, the Attorney General of New York demanding everything, the judge going along with the demands, the judge. And this is the point here. when I say first principles, I'm talking about principles of justice, a lot of which can be found in things like Magna Carta, but which have all been perverted because there's a difference between a land of laws and a land of legalisms. This is now a land of men. So, for example, you can destroy, an attorney general is given license to destroy a non-criminal enterprise, such as Peter Brimelow's. But if you actually are running a criminal enterprise, as, say, members of the Biden family are, you're never going to be called on that. You're never going to be called to cough up paperwork on this and that. And so what you have is this, you have this hideous legal sophistry, which makes me want to vomit, which afflicts America. It's very simple. It's an affront to justice to do what this attorney general is doing to Peter Brimelow and VDare.com. But everybody, too many conservatives react. It's always, this is not the hill to die on. We don't want to go to bat. We don't want to go to bat for VDare.com because they're a bit icky for our taste. They keep going on about immigrants. Okay. Well, they're going to be, I would never have won in Canada. I got that law repealed, even though Justin Trudeau wants to bring it back now, but I got it repealed. I would not have got it repealed if we hadn't actually opened a can of whoop-ass, as I believe the American vernacular is, on the Human Rights Commission for what they were doing to Mark Lemire. Mark Lemire, it's like Mark Lemire, as I said, he was not an attractive person. In terms, you know, he's not like the Human Rights Tribunal dragging Margaret Atwood into court. Or Celine Dion, but principles are principles. And the principle here is that everyone is equal before the law. And they are if you have a country that decides which people can benefit from the protections of the law and which people are without the law, to channel Kipling, then basically you're not in a constitutional republic, you're in a post-constitutional crap hole. There's no point pretending otherwise about it. That's what I talk about with first principles. that you start, it's not about conservative or liberal, right wing or left wing. In a free society, you start with the principle articulated by Lord Moulton, that the majority of human existence should not actually be regulated by the state. Now, America's completely forgotten that. And clearly, you know, that's why nobody cares about elections anymore, because the administrative state means that whoever wins gets to impose burdens on you regardless. So one of my first principles is that in a free society, there's some stuff that you're obligated to do at one end, you know, like join the army if they have conscription or whatever. And there's some stuff down at the other end that you're not, that you're forbidden to do, like murder people. But that the huge gap in between, which ought to be in a healthy society, 85 to 90% of life, should you regulate yourself in that sphere. The minute you make everything left-wing or right-wing, conservative or socialist, you destroy a nation. And so the first principle is, way to think about things in first principles is not just, does this apply only to me and my friends? That's the friend-enemy thing that you have now, that Veronica from Auckland writes about in our comments a lot, that everything, the who whom thing, which is a Stalinist way of looking at the world. It doesn't matter. I defended John Edwards, you know, the oleaginous, fornicating creep who was John Kerry's vice presidential running mate. He's one of the most disgusting, creepy, smarmy, twerpy guys I've ever had the misfortune to encounter in, I think it was Gorham, New Hampshire. But that business where they went up, he knocked up his mistress, and the mistress gave birth to a love child, as they say in Fleet Street. And so he was dragged into court on the grounds that his the cost of his love child was a campaign finance violation. I loathe John Edwards, but that was a perversion of the course of justice, and I was happy to defend him on that. The guy, what's he called? Michael Savage, the talk show host. Whenever anyone brings up my name on his show, he's always rude about me. He doesn't like me. I've no idea why. I don't know him. The only thing I ever did for him was when the British Home Secretary, she banned a bunch of people from entering the UK. And as is the way, most of them were called Mohammed. And so she needed some guy who wasn't called Mohammed. So she decided to ban Michael Savage from setting foot in the UK. And I intervened on his behalf with that, too. Because not because I like Michael Savage, he's always rude about me, but because that's the only point of law. The only point of law is it's the only point of free speech is for speech you hate. The only point of law is that it's for people you hate too. The minute law becomes just for your friends and free speech becomes just for people you agree with, you are beyond law and beyond freedom. Joe Crisotti says that's the way to look at everything. Joe Crisotti says, dear Mark, I'm really enjoying your collection of essays. In Mark's Sign from Head to Toe, the events described from only 20 or 30 years ago seem to come from an entirely different era. One of the articles I most enjoyed was your piece on the writer Mordecai Richler, of whom I know next to nothing. In the midst of your essay, you mentioned appearing on a radio show with him and Garrison Keillor. That really caught my attention. Could you expand upon it? I hadn't thought about Keillor in a long while, but thinking about him now makes me sad, maybe nostalgic. While I was always turned off by his politics, I still enjoyed him as a talented radio personality. I don't know where he is today, but I feel his Me Too cancellation was a small cultural loss. Any thoughts? Yeah, for those, Garrison Keillor had this show on National Public Radio that ran for best part of half a century. It was called A Prairie Home Companion. And it was like the shows that, what was it called? National Barn Dance. I think that's celebrating its 100th anniversary roundabout now. Well, I don't actually know whether it's still on, but the kind of big variety shows on radio that used to get in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And he created a parody, a sort of smart guys, a kind of NPR parody version of it. And I was never that kind of keen on it. But it made him a huge star, even though I got the impression that he liked these shows genuinely and he would much rather have, done an authentic version of it, as it were. But over the fullness of time, it became a kind of authentic version. And I read a couple of his books. I read he wrote WLT, a novel about a radio station from the early days of radio up to the dawn of television. And it's like a novelized version of the Prairie Home Companion. And I enjoyed that too. It's you never get much sense of it. It's a real radio novel in the sense that it's never very clear what any of the characters look like. But I enjoyed it. I thought he was a talented man. Now, he's a lefty. But, if you take out all the lefties, you'd have a very small record collection and a very small movie collection. That's just the nature of the way it is. Then he got Me Too'd by Minnesota Public Radio. And they killed him. They destroyed him. They vaporized him, which is slightly amazing to me. They basically took out a great liberal icon. And what's interesting to me is that he had, his whole thing was this small town Minnesota. I think that what I said about Mordecai Richler, I was doing my BBC show from New York, from Rockefeller Center, Fifth Avenue, just across from St. Patrick's Cathedral. And I forget who the third guest was that day, but Mordecai and Garrison Keillor, and I forget who the third person was. And Mordecai has this had this reputation as a huge curmudgeon. And in fact, he was a darling. And, you know, we went out and downed a rather large quantity. I think we went to the Algonquin, was it? The bar there. And had a lot of whereas Garrison Keillor was known as doing all this cuddly small town Minnesota stuff, and he was just this big, forbidding, cold one of these people. It's very difficult when you're on the radio with someone totally cold, because the coldness is sort of palpable. You can feel the room losing temperature, whereas Mordecai was very cuddly. I think, you know, this is the thing, though. He's what most people know about Minnesota. Lake Wobegon, and they're all Lutherans, and all the kids are above average, and all the rest of it. Whereas that isn't Minnesota now. Minnesota's semi-Somali. And you can't have Somalis in Lake Wobegon. So people won't get it. People won't understand his Lake Wobegon things in 20 or 30 years' time, simply because that world was destroyed by the political party that he supported. Frank Gallenstein says, Mark, I just read where a judge decided on Tuesday to allow Special Prosecutor Jack Smith to shield the identity of witnesses against Trump in the so-called mishandling of documents case on the grounds that, quote, it would expose them to intimidation and harassment from Trump. Whatever happened to being able to face your accusers? And harassment from Trump? Who is the harasser? I've got that wrong. Do they say harass? I said harassment. Is it harassment in American? I used to be so good at this. You say tomato, I say tomato, and I was never wrong, and now I'm blowing it. So what is it? Is it harassment or harassment? I'll ask Frank Gallenstein. Or Frank Gallenstein. You're quite right. So here's the thing now. The witnesses against Trump are basically are regarded as rape victims or child sexual abuse victims. You know, their anonymity has to be protected. Again, this doesn't happen if it was the other way around and you were to accuse Hunter Biden or Joe Biden. It's the degeneration. It makes it not possible to live in the same society. It's completely ludicrous. The judges are all in the pockets of the prosecutors. This judge is in the pocket of Special Prosecutor Jack Smith. Judge Engeron is in the pocket of Letitia James. And whatever the V-Dare judge is, she is also in the pocket of Letitia James. This is terrible. You know, and again, don't wave that Constitution. The Constitution has failed. And the conservative wankers thinking that as long as you can wave that Constitution, that nothing bad will happen. You can surrender every other lever in society, but the Constitution will always be there for you. Have you been to an American law school of late? Who do you think, you think these judges are bad, who do you think is going to be the judges in 10 years' time? This is disgraceful. But as I said, we had somebody who wrote to us who said, oh, yeah, you know, yeah, so the dirty, stinking, rotten, corrupt justice system, so what? So what? You know, conservatives want a level playing field. So that, for example, if Black Lives Matter call up the Marriott Hotel and want to book the ballroom for a conference, the Marriott Hotel will say fine. If VDare.com want to call up the Marriott will initially take the booking and then cancel it at the last minute after it's been pressured by other people. So increasingly, dissenting views are being crowded out of the public square. And people can say, well, you know, the Marriott Hotel is entitled to decide who it wants to let into its ballroom or whatever. But we have gone way beyond that now, because now we have judges in courtrooms implying, essentially customizing the norms of justice according to which side of the political spectrum you fall on. Nothing good will come of that. A Clockwork Cabbage writes, possibly not his real name or her real name, says, best wishes for improving health. What is your take on the possibility of looming elections bringing on the worst? In America and Great Britain, there is a real chance of a Democratic Party and Labour Party victory, respectively, which will likely mean an entrenchment and even enhancement of woke progressive politics. The electorates in said two nations may end up committing seppuku with a rusty blade yet. Of course, if the cynical uniparty hypothesis is correct, it will be disappointment and damnation on any turn. Another point, do Americans appreciate the real possibility that when they vote in the presidential election, it is really the VP on the ticket who will be the real heir to the Oval Office? There is a good chance that for various reasons, neither Biden nor Trump would finish a four-year term. So what's it going to be, the insubstantial Kamala of the Dems or the yet unnamed Mr. or Ms. X of the GOP, the Republican Convention? Better choose wisely. What you're saying there is rather disturbing, because in the case of Biden, people have been trained not to believe their lying eyes. So when they see him wandering around unable to get off a stage, or when they see him falling down on the steps of Air Force One, they have been trained to discount it. So I find it unbelievable that were Biden to be inaugurated in January 2025, that he will serve until January 2029. But apparently, half the country, more or less, does. They think they're electing Joe Biden to do his best for the United States of America all the way to January 2029. Your other point about the cynical uniparty hypothesis, it's not cynical. It's that in both the examples you cite, in the US and the UK, the permanent state, the administrative state, has rendered democratic elections increasingly irrelevant. So the point is that you can vote for change, but you're not going to get any change. And that's the system they like. And they're pretty confident that that's the way it's going to be from now on. Now, there's a difference when you say the Democrat victory and the Labour Party victory, because one would be the continuation in office of the Biden administration, and the other would be the rejection of 14 years of conservative prime ministers who have done nothing conservative. Nothing conservative. David Cameron, Theresa May, Boris Johnson, Liz Truss for a couple of weeks, and Rishi Sunak, all a complete waste of time. And people are mad about it. And I do believe it will mean an entrenchment and even enhancement, as Clockwork Cabbage puts it, of woke progressive politics. But let's just say that the Tories managed to win in the UK. And let's say that Trump managed to win and drag a Republican House and Senate over the finishing line with him. Then the question to ask on the Trump side is, what's going to be different? You know, Paul Ryan and Mitch, the people who defeated, the reason there's no wall is because Trump got rolled by Ryan and McConnell. Now, Trump understands that. Trump knows that. And Trump actually, you know, it's possible to, and there are lots of people, Ann Coulter and others, who absolutely despise Trump for getting rolled. But what he's been doing these last few months in the face of these lawsuits, that's epic. I don't know how he takes it. I can't take the strain on me, health-wise, from just two little rinky-dink lawsuits. I don't know how he can take, you know, Judge Engeron and all these other guys. I don't know how he takes that. But I'll tell you something. The deep state are basically pretty confident that in the event they can't steal it away from him in November, that they'll be able to neuter him. Now, you don't even have to worry about that in the event of Sir Keir Starmer winning in London, because if Sir Keir is walking into Downing Street, when you say an entrenchment and even enhancement of woke progressive politics, let's say that Rishi pulls it off and he walks back into Downing Street, it'll still be entrenchment and enhancement of woke progressive politics. Who the hell gave Ofcom, Dame Melanie Dawes and Lord Grade, jurisdiction over the internet? It was a so-called conservative government. They're not conservative. They've done nothing conservative. Chris Davis says, Mark, following the subjugation of the House of Commons to appease the Islamic mob a few weeks back by the Speaker at the request of the leader of the opposition. Yeah, if you didn't see this, if you don't follow news in Britain, this is basically came up since the whole business with Gaza, the October 7th, that MPs in various constituencies with large Muslim populations live in fear of being physically assaulted or maybe even murdered, as one member of parliament was a couple of years ago. These guys live in fear of their Muslim populations, and because of that, the Speaker of the House of Commons, Speaker of the House of Commons basically repudiated the House's own procedures in order that the ugly reality of the Islamic intimidation in UK politics would not emerge. And Chris now says, we now have the deputy leader of the opposition, a.k.a. the Ginger Growler. Yes, that's what I always used to call her on GB News, because Angela Rayner, she's a vivacious redhead, and she claimed never to wear knickers so that she could flash the Tories what she called her ginger growler. Anyway, so that's how I always refer to her. She said it, not me. The ginger growler caught with her pants down, avoiding capital gains tax, but refusing to stand down. Yeah, this is where she and her lover, they were living at the guy's pad, but she had as her official primary residence some home of her own. Not a big home, it's worth 150,000 quid, 130,000 quid, something like that. But by when she sold it, because she'd claimed it as her primary residence, she didn't pay capital gains tax on it. Whereas if she'd said, oh, actually, I'm living with Loverboy in this other house, so this isn't my primary residence. And Chris goes, of course, well, the thing about it is, yeah, nothing's going to happen. Even in Britain, the there's a difference between, you know, the left always stand with their guys. So they're not going to sacrifice Angela Rayner over this. Of course, the so-called Tories, says Chris Davis, are no angels, with the latest act of self-harm being William Ragg being blackmailed on Grindr after showing his todger to the wrong recipient and releasing the phone numbers of a dozen of his colleagues, as you do. When it comes to scandal, does it pay to sit on the left? Yeah, that's an easy question. Yes, it does. But yeah, this guy's Tory MP. The Tory MPs are not like the Tory MPs were in my day. So he's on... Why would you, if you're a member of Parliament, do you think it's a good idea to go on Grindr and show your todger? You have no idea who you're showing. At least in the old days, there was an element of human judgment. You had to go to the seedy part of town, go into a bar, and at least and you had to show your todger in person. So you were more a certain prudence dictated you be careful about that. Now putting your todger out there on the internet and then responding by giving the guy the personal mobile telephone numbers of a dozen other members of Parliament. These are the worst. I can't get over the way. These are the worst. This is the worst generation of political class ever. Ever, ever, ever. Toby Pilling says, this is going to have to be the last question. How long do you think until your beloved Red Ensign is tweaked into a more modern rainbow design? Don't even say that. I think that, what is this a reference to? Is this to do with the Nike redesigning the flag of England on some stupid outfit or other to look gayer? So they're going to come up with an LGBT QWERTY Red Ensign. What a horrible thought. I don't even want to think about that. I'm not going to go there, Toby. That's a really grim note. We've had a fairly grim note. So we ought to really, all through the show, really. But that was the grimmest. So let's cheer things up. Last time I was here, I played Sarah Vaughan and Billy Eckstine singing Passing Strangers, written by Rita Mann and Mel Mitchell. And I said, if you're wondering who they are, well, Mel Mitchell also wrote Petticoats of Portugal. And there were some jackanapes in the comments, jackanapes who mocked Petticoats of Portugal. I'm looking at you, Greg Warren in New South Wales, Down Under, who wrote Petticoats of Portugal, a sweet song, but not as swinging as Knickers of Norway. And then Olga from Arizona, another jackanapes, weighed in to say that she preferred Teddies of Tanzania. Mocking. Mocking one of the great artifacts of Western culture as our civilization slides off the cliff. Well, we're not going to put up with that. So just for Greg and Olga and all the other scoffers, stand well back, Petticoats of Portugal.
Of Portugal, there's quite a show on the streets of Portugal. Each passerby winks his eye, whistles and smiles. The oohs and ahs, loud hurrahs, echo for miles. Those shapes gowns, neath petticoats of Portugal, start traffic jams,
the cop on the square doesn't care. There's not a guy alive who doesn't thrive on watching skirts blow free, especially the petticoats of Portugal. Especially the petticoats of Portugal.
Dick Jacobs with his orchestra and chorus and the Petticoats of Portugal by Mike Merle and Mel. That's Mike Durso, Merle Kahn and Mel Mitchell. There's not a guy alive who doesn't thrive on watching skirts blow free. Is that still true? We live in the age of the bepenist woman. So the wind could be blowing rather more your way than you're up for. Oh, well, if I were to go on TV and say there's not a guy alive who doesn't thrive on watching skirts blow free, I'd never work again. On the other hand, if I put on a skirt and go in the ladies' changing room at Macy's, no problem. I'm as much a woman as anybody else in there, and you're a hater if you object. Our world is mad. Où sont les petticoats de Portugal d'antan? Stick with Stein Online for our regular Thursday date with Laura's Links. Laura Rosen-Cohen will be here to round up the internet as only she can. We'll have a new Tale for Our Time on Friday and something rather special coming this weekend. Our official Stein versus the Stick trial merchandise is still available, only now it's the official merchandising for the appellate hearing, plus ça change, plus la même case under the American system of trial by ordeal. We ordered this stuff over a decade ago, so we even have Stein versus the Stick mouse pads. We probably have a Stein versus the Stick hula hoop or buggy whip lying around here somewhere. If you don't fancy those, there's always a Stein Online gift certificate or a Mark Stein Club gift membership. Your loved ones will thank you for that one. Stay safe, stay free, stay well, stay out of court.
Mark Stein's Clubland Q&A is a production of Mark Stein Enterprises and Oak Hill Media. All rights reserved.